From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The science of sleep is one of the youngest fields in science. 19th century philosophers argued that people fall asleep when they run out of stimulating thoughts. Until the middle of the 20th century, most people figured when we were sleeping, our brains were too. But the journalist David Randall argues sleep is not a break from our lives. In fact, it's the missing third of the puzzle that reveals our life's meaning. Today in the program, David Randall talks about the strange science of sleep and the powerful impact it has on our lives. It's an impact, he says, that's probably bigger than what we eat, how much money we make, or where we live. So sleep, then, is our creativity, it's our emotions, and it's our health. Dreamland today, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It wasn't so long ago that most of us thought when we went to sleep, most everything just shut down, our brains included. The 1950s, scientists discovered this concept of rapid eye movement in sleep, and they realized, well, something's going on. David Randall says the study of sleep is really one of the youngest fields of science, and researchers believe they're in this golden age of the field. Today, Randall says sleep is understood as a complex process that affects everything from the legal system to the global economy to the way we define our sense of happiness. Today in the program, David Randall is joining us to talk about his book called Dreamland. It talks about the powerful impact that sleep has on our lives. He says it's probably bigger than what we eat or how much money we make or where we live. David Randall is a senior reporter for Reuters News Agency, an adjunct professor also of journalism at New York University. His writing has appeared in Forbes, New York Magazine, and the New York Times. Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep, is his first book. He's joining us today from the studios of NPR in New York City. And David Randall, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's start with the story of how you got to thinking about this, because, you started to sleepwalk. That's what got you into the story, I guess. Just talk about that.
Exactly. It was a topic that literally hit me in the face. I started sleepwalking about two or three summers ago, and one night I woke up on my back in the hallway, terrible pain in my knee, you know, soreness in my face, and I realized I had sleepwalked into a wall. I quickly realized, you know, this was not something I wanted to do again. I don't know if you've ever sleepwalked into anything, but it is very painful. So I went to my doctor, I spent a night in the sleep lab, you know, all that stuff. Go back a couple days later, and he was searching, going through all the studies and looking at, you know, what he could see to help me or not. And he said, you know what, I have to be honest. There's a lot we know about sleep, but there's a lot we don't know. So the best advice I can give you is, you know, take it easy and see what happens. And this was disconcerting. You know, it's the first time I'd been to a doctor, and they essentially said, I don't know. I don't know what I can do to help you. It was as if I sleepwalked past the frontier. So I decided, you know, if sleep was affecting me like this, then there has to be affecting other people as well. So I wanted to find out everything I could about sleep, and not just the medical part of how to help myself, which was, you know, obviously a selfish motivation, which is a good one too. Yeah. Helps you learn more. But I wanted to know, why don't we know more about this? This seems such a basic part of life. It almost seems like someone saying they don't know anything about digestion. You know, it's something that seems, you know, self-evident. So I decided, you know, I want to find out how sleep is affecting my life, how it's affecting other people's lives, especially because I kept asking people these what seemed like basic questions. You know, why do we dream? How does sleep affect sports teams? How does sleep affect high school students? And I just got all these I don't knows. And it seemed like this universal part of life was the great unknown.
Why do you figure it is that, I mean, I mentioned this in the introduction, that it's this, the study of sleep is one of the youngest fields of science. Why is it that people didn't look into it or hadn't or didn't have any answers for it? Do you think you understand why that is? Is it because it seems so mysterious? I mean, you write about, and we'll get to this as we go, but there are, you know, connections in other times between sleep and death. Is it because we find it creepy or mysterious in some way?
Oh, that's a great question. And that's part of it. You know, so much of it was, it's when you think about sleep, it's essentially a very, very weird thing to do. You know, essentially you go away from conscious thought. You know, you think about it in an evolutionary perspective, you put yourself, you suddenly become very, very vulnerable. But I think one of the big reasons why sleep wasn't studied was the lack of technology in a way, too. Mm. You know, we discovered, you know, we being sleep scientists, discovered rapid eye movement sleep in the 1950s, thanks in part because technology that allowed us to see brainwaves. You know, when they first discovered rapid eye movement sleep, they actually thought the machine was messing up. They thought, how can somebody's brain be moving this much, you know, exhibiting, it almost looked like somebody was awake.
Yeah.
But, you know, you looked in the window and the person was obviously asleep. So the person went in to see what was happening. And that's when they saw the eyelids dancing across. You know, the person's eyes were closed, but they say their eyes moving, you know, the rapid eye movement.
Yeah.
And, you know, they shined a flashlight into the person's eyes and realized, wow, this is a completely different stage of consciousness than we ever thought was possible. So sleep scientists like to say that we actually have three stages of consciousness. We have, you know, awake, what we see every day. We have sleep, most of sleep, and then we have REM sleep, which is when your body, your brain is as active as it is when you're awake. You're just completely asleep.
Mm. In the book, you write about how our understanding of sleep really hasn't changed all that much over hundreds and hundreds of years. Talk a little bit about that. We used to think, for example, that when we sleep, you know, that our brains shut down for a time. And you write about how the Greeks thought that when you fell asleep because your brain became full of blood.
Exactly. They really didn't have, you know, they being scientists throughout history, really didn't have much of an understanding of sleep at all. There were theories that, you know, Plato basically thought that it was pressure on the brain from your blood that made you fall asleep. You know, Greek mythology kind of shows how creepy they thought sleep was too.
Yeah.
You know, the god of sleep was the brother of the god of death,
right.
And their mother was the night. And when you think, it's probably something you didn't want to think about when you're trying to fall asleep one night. It was just kind of spooky, the whole thing that, you know, are you alive? Are you dead? How you can come back? Just this big kind of absence from life. And the 19th century, or 18th and 19th century, that was when the idea came about that you fell asleep because you ceased having, you know, ambitious thoughts or desires. It was almost as if you gave up, and that's why you fell asleep. So that's when we kind of got the sense of if you're sleeping too much, you're lazy, you're an unserious person, you're kind of not fit to be with the rest of us. So that's why, you know, if you still go in certain careers today, you know, Wall Street, lawyers, you know, salesmen, all these other kind of high-pressure jobs, if somebody in one of those careers talks about sleeping or seems to enjoy it too much, there's almost like this, you know, scarlet letter. It's almost like this idea of, you know, you're not a serious person if you like sleep this much and you seem to enjoy it. You know, and Thomas Edison, you know, he famously thought that sleep was bad for you.
Yeah.
He never really explained why, but he basically thought that the longer that we're awake, the more we're going to become, you know, nurtured. We're going to push ourselves to a harder, to another level. It was almost as if staying awake was, you know, a form of improvement, you know, industrialization of the self.
Let's talk about Roger Ekirch. Or Ekirch,
Ekirch.
Roger Ekirch, he's this intriguing character you write on the book, who was kind of this unlikely figure to come up with what he did, which was this breakthrough about sleep, because he's a history professor. And he's interesting because he came to his insights through plays and wills and other kind of old writing. Talk about him, if you will.
He was as far away from the sleep labs as you would think for somebody who came across a huge breakthrough. He's a professor at Virginia Tech. And, you know, at the time he was teaching classes about, you know, colonial slave trade and all these other things about the beginning of the United States. And he just on a whim, you know, had a personal interest in the history of the night. So he started thinking, how was night different, you know, 400-500 years ago? So he was going through, you know, the Canterbury Tales. He was going through wills. He was going through, you know, old primers on how to spot a ghost and things like that. And he started picking up again and again these references to first sleep and second sleep.
Yeah.
And it happened enough that he realized perhaps we didn't sleep the same way that we always thought we did. You know, we tend to think of, you know, we go to bed at 10 o'clock each night, and we're supposed to sleep for, you know, consolidated 8 straight hours, yeah. You know, wake up at 6, nothing in between. And he realized that sleep was completely different. You know, you would fall asleep, it was still around 10 or so. You'd stay that way until about 1 o'clock or 2. Then you'd wake up for an hour, and you expected to, and you'd stay that way for, you know, for an hour. And that's when you would think about your dreams. You would read. You would talk with your loved one. You would, you know, have sex, you know, what have you.
Yeah.
And then you'd go back to sleep. So this was, you know, this was a breakthrough. But what really, he kept on seeing this and thought, wow, this is amazing, basically. He wouldn't have published it necessarily, he told me, if it wasn't for another study that coincidentally happened at the same time, and not very far away. And Bethesda, Maryland, a psychiatrist who was working for National Institutes of Health, basically on a whim too, decided, you know, we have all this electric light. What is the effect of it?
Right.
I'm going to sequester subjects in a study away from electric lights and see what happens. So for the first week or two, these subjects slept as much as they wanted. It was almost like kids in a candy store, you know, sleeping 14 hours a night to make up from all that lost sleep from showing up to work too early or staying out too late. Then after, you know, a week or two, that's when they started exhibiting the same first sleep and second sleep behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, they also would wake up in between, and they would describe that time as feeling so rested and calm and relaxed. And, you know, the scientists even drew their blood to see, was there something more than this? And they found that there were higher levels of prolactin, which is the hormone that it's also surging through chickens' bloods when, you know, they're sitting on their eggs in a contented haze. So it was almost as if these subjects, because they're away from electric light, were exercising a muscle they never knew they had. And it implies that perhaps this segmented sleep, you know, this first sleep and second sleep, is part of the innate wiring of our brains, and that we're all almost sleeping unnaturally. And that, you know, if you wake up at 2 in the morning and you think, why am I awake? I'm so aware, you know, and you turn to a sleeping pill, you might be medicating a condition that is natural. You know, it's just part of the human body.
You know, it's interesting. I wonder about, because you write about animals and how they sleep, for example. And I mean, you write about, for example, how it seems to be, you know, you would have this impression that, you know, the further up in the food chain you are, the longer you would assume that you'd be able to sleep, you know. But you say it doesn't really work out that way. I mean, doesn't seem to be any kind of consistent rule. You talk about how lions sleep, you know, a long time, but gerbils do too, and tigers sleep a long time, but squirrels do too. And then you write about how elephants usually only sleep about 3.5 hours at a time, how a giraffe sleeps about 1.5 hours in these kinds of blocks. And I'm wondering, is that how humans, do we have any sense that maybe that's how humans are supposed to do it, that we're sleeping in these blocks because we were once prey? I mean, do we know why it is that we sleep naturally in some ways? We tend to be segmented sleepers if we let it happen that way?
That's a great question, and it's something that is almost impossible for scientists to answer to a certain extent, too. You know, it's hard to imagine what sleeping conditions were like to a certain extent, you know, 5,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago. But there's also this idea where when you take it to looking at circadian rhythms, too, which is a circadian rhythm is basically the 24-hour, it's a little bit longer, but the 24-hour clock that all of us have kind of naturally. You know, our bodies have a clock that's built based on the sun. And this circadian rhythm changes as you age. That's why teenagers generally find it, you know, impossible to fall asleep before 11 p.m. And it's really hard to wake up before 7 a.m. You know, that's why high school is so hard to get to that first period. But then as you age, you know, as you get older, you know, 55, 60, 65, you go to sleep earlier, but then you sleep lighter and you wake up so much earlier too. It's very common, you know, for somebody over 65 to talk about, oh, you know, I wake up at 3 in the morning. I just stay awake that way for a while. And there's a theory by Carol Worthman. She's an anthropologist at Emory University in Atlanta. And her basic idea was that, you know, perhaps humans are built to live in big groups with different generations, spanning the generations. So if we're all on this kind of different schedule in terms of sleeping, perhaps that means that somebody's always awake, you know, and somebody's always kind of on watch.
Yeah.
That, you know, somebody's protecting the group. When you think about sleep, it is terrifying to a certain extent that, you know, we live in a world of finite resources and, you know, living things resort to eating each other to survive. So the idea of falling asleep, would I almost say, invite vulnerability in here. You know, say, predator, come make me dinner, and not in a good way.
Right.
So perhaps, you know, if somebody's always awake, then somebody's always on watch, and we always have this protection.
Of course, this raises the question of what effect artificial light and all the things that come with it have on our sleep. I mean, Roger Ekirch is writing about how scary it was before artificial light. And what's so interesting about that is, and he realized that everything changed at night. I mean, the rules and the rhythms of culture and society. But then we get artificial light. And you talk about how we really shook off the associations with fear. And now, as you write in the book, it became the time when all the good stuff happens. So talk about the kind of health effects now that we have artificial light introduced at night.
Exactly. You know, 300, 400 years ago, night was terrifying. You know, people would literally lock themselves in their room, their homes at night. They had no idea it was out there. Once artificial light came in the last 100 years ago with the perfection of the light bulb, suddenly we have a 24-hour day, and we can function as well at night, or we can see as well at night as we could during the day. And, you know, factories were some of the first to realize this. Some of the first battles in the labor battles in the U.S. were over the length of those first graveyard shifts.
Yeah.
You know, if you could suddenly have people working in the factory at 2 a.m. when the same conditions as 2 p.m., then output could just increase exponentially. But now they're realizing that there are definite trade-offs from that. There have been research studies that show the outcome over having late-night shifts over a long time. And researchers tend to have looked at nurses again and again in these studies, in part because they're easy to find, obviously. But they're also, you know, nurses generally have pretty good health records. You know, they're around the medical community all the time. They have an idea of what goes into their bodies or not. And the research has shown that, you know, working night shifts for a long time has been found to have higher rates of certain kinds of cancer.
Yeah.
And it's not something that intrinsically you would think. You know, almost you think that if you worked next to an X-ray machine for 30 years, perhaps you might have a drawback from that.
Right.
But just working from, you know, midnight to 8 over 30 years, you wouldn't think it would have the same effect, but it did. And part of the reason researchers now think is that, you know, staying up that long basically throws our hormones out of whack. For women, you know, if there's less melatonin, which is the hormone in your body that helps you fall asleep, it's almost like a nursery rhyme for your bloodstream. That can change the levels of estrogen in your body, and that perhaps can have an effect on breast cancer. There was a study in Israel, too, that found that if a woman lived in a place where there was so much light pollution, which is what it's called when the light at night is basically so much brighter than it would be naturally. If it was so much light pollution that someone could sit on their front step, basically, and read a book without any extra light, that woman was so much more likely to have breast cancer than someone who lived in a comparatively much darker place. And, you know, researchers are still trying to figure out why that is. You know, perhaps this is a correlation, perhaps there's a true causation here, but it is something that was significant.
It's in this chapter of the book where you write about the tradition of the midday nap. Talk a little bit about that. The idea of a nap appears throughout the book in some ways, and how we've thought about naps, and what the global economy is doing to the idea of a nap. Say something about that.
Traditionally, we tend to think of naps as, you know, I think the first thing most people think of is the siesta.
Yeah.
You know, in Spain and other Latin countries, there's this idea that you fall asleep, you know, sometime around 2 and stay that way, you know, for an hour or two, and it's just kind of a nice break. Most people don't realize that there's the same tradition in China, too. I've, you know, spoken with people, you know, Americans who go to work for companies there, and, you know, they're managing Chinese workers and you know, office workers, and they suddenly see people falling asleep at their desks, and they think, you know, what's going on here? And basically, they have to, you know, they have to find out that, oh, wait, there's this tradition of sleep in the afternoon too. So in Spain, this is becoming more and more of an issue. Not very long ago, you know, 2 or 3 years, the Spanish government basically severely curtailed the siesta time they gave to government workers. And the idea was if they cut it back for government workers, it would kind of go into the private sector as well. And the idea was that they want Spanish workers to be at their desks the same time everybody else in Europe is too. This idea that everybody has to be working on the same schedule. There's not that time to perhaps have this tradition of sleeping and napping, which in many ways is actually very, you know, in the book I talk about the benefits of naps, which is, you know, shown by studies of astronauts and all military and all these other people. And companies like Nike and Google are, you know, encouraging workers to nap at work now. But at the same time, it's this kind of clash of cultures in terms of what is sleep and is it actually good for us or is it something that we should be able to look past and, you know, kind of charge on through if we have enough coffee and ignore it and we can still be perfect. It's almost that same clash that came about with Thomas Edison, you know, this idea of that we should always be at our best without sleep.
You write about the work of Martin Moore Eddy, a former professor at Harvard Medical School, and he's now runs one of the largest companies in this field called fatigue management. And you talk about the fact that he really kind of challenges Edison's ideas because in some ways our workplace hadn't been updated since the time of Edison, at least in terms of the way we think about sleep.
Exactly. And, you know, Dr. Moretti, he's now worked with over half of the Fortune 500 companies to talk about this idea of fatigue management. So much of it obviously goes into the transportation issues, transportation companies. You know, he told me about working with railroad companies, and they were saying, you know, they had certain amount of transportation costs per every million miles they went. And he looked at the studies, he looked at the work schedules, and he identified, you know, so many of these accidents are caused by just simple fatigue. You know, workers are on for a 15-hour shift, and they're on, you know, or they're on for a 12-hour shift, and they're doing that for 30 days straight. So, of course, at the end of those 30 days, they're simply not at their best. They're no longer what we would think of as competent workers. So there's going to be accidents. So he changed their schedules. He made it so that each worker was given the chance for more sleep, that they weren't having those kind of back-to-back-to-back days of long work, and transportation or accident costs plummeted. There was there was an accident at Texas City. It's a big refinery area kind of southwest of Houston. And, you know, there was an area that manufactured and refined jet fuel. And there was a big explosion there. And this was 2008 or 2009. And you know, the studies came in, or researchers came in, they wanted to identify what happened. You know, several workers died in this accident, this big explosion. And they pointed to fatigue, it was simple fatigue, that workers had been on for 30 straight days of this long shift, and they were no longer functioning well. You know, studies have now shown that if you go as long as, you know, simple sleep deprivation generally is less than 6 hours of sleep a night, you know, we tend to need 8 hours sleep. Right. What 8 hours comes from, you know, 2 hours for 1 hour of sleep for every 2 hours that we're awake. So that's where the whole 8 hours comes from. If you go with less than 6 hours of sleep at night, you're essentially going to act like you're drunk. You know, there's a study in 2000 which separated subjects, and this was done in Australia, and some of the subjects were Australian army soldiers. And they basically compared their abilities on the simulated driving test as somebody went longer and longer without sleep. They compared those who just sleep deprived and those who were legally drunk. And those who were legally drunk performed better. You know, they had a better spatial awareness. They had made better decisions. They had a better sense of time, and they were less emotional. So, you know, this whole thing basically comes back to the idea that sleep makes you competent. It's not just, you know, it feels good or you're lazy if you need to sleep. You sleep because you need to perform well. Mm.
David Randall is with us. His book is Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. Thank you. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring the mystery of sleep. Despite the fact that we spend nearly a third of our lives doing it, we don't really know that much about sleep, like why our bodies need it, why we dream, why some of us snore. The journalist David Randall's our guest today. He set out to discover whatever he could about that period of time he calls where we only conceive of as an abstraction. His book is called Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. David Randall, one of the things you do in the book is you kind of take us through the as you put it, the story of a night. What is happening? Because you say we've now identified sleep comes in a series of stages. What is happening when we sleep?
Basically, we go through this cycle. There's five stages of sleep. You know, the first one is so light that if you were woken up from it, you wouldn't think you were actually asleep. Yeah. Stage two, and each stage is named for basically the brain waves and the speed of the brain waves that you see. So stage two becomes a little bit deeper sleep. You get the first sleep-specific brain waves. Stage three, deeper still. Stage four is the farthest away from conscious thought you really go. If you wake somebody up from stage four sleep, they're going to want nothing more than to fall instantly back to sleep.
Right.
You know, they're not going to know what their name is. They're not going to be able to do anything else. Then stage five is basically REM sleep, REM sleep. And this is a stage when your brain is as aware and active as it is when you're awake. This is the stage that researchers call paradoxical sleep. Because if you were just looking at the brain waves, you would think this person is clearly awake. But at that time, you know, you're asleep. And your body has essentially sent out hormones that effectively paralyze itself so that you don't act out the story that's going on in your head.
See, that's so interesting. I mean, basically, so it shuts it down. So, you know, a lot of us have dogs who can see them sort of trying to run a little bit while they seem to be dreaming. I don't know if you have a dog, but I mean, so I'm figuring, oh, that's what they're doing is they're running in their dream. But that's what REM does. It sort of, but it, for the most part, sort of paralyzes, you know, our limbs. So we don't act it out. But when you sleepwalk, does that thing malfunction?
Essentially, the researchers don't know exactly how or why, though. You know, some sleepwalking takes place during REM sleep.
Yeah.
So that's a disorder called REM behavior disorder, basically. So your body's not paralyzed. Other sleepwalking takes place in those first stages of sleep when you're kind of still going in between, in and out of conscious thought. Most people don't realize that when you fall asleep, you actually wake up. You can wake up 50 times over the span of a night, but you just might wake up for 2 or 3 seconds at a time. And that's never captured into conscious thought and memory. So you're always kind of going in and out. Think of sleep kind of like you're bobbing in the ocean waves. You know, your head surfaces, then you go back down. Your head surfaces, you go back down. So these five stages, they don't go, you know, always 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 instantly and you know, for a set amount of time. You might go from stage 2 to 4 to REM sleep back to stage 1 and kind of jumbled around. But for some sleepwalking does take place in these first stages of sleep, and researchers don't necessarily know why. It's not necessarily that you're acting out a dream. It could be that you have an impulse and your brain's literally half asleep and you don't have that conscious thought of sequestering it and preventing it.
You know that wives tale about how, you know, it's really dangerous to wake a person up who's sleepwalking?
Exactly.
Is there anything to it?
That's a great question. It depends on how old the person is.
Huh.
It's very common for somebody, you know, when kids, you know, 12 or younger, it's pretty common for them to sleepwalk. You know, something like 30 or 40% of kids sleepwalk at least once in their lives. But as you get older, it becomes less common. But also it can be a sign of a more serious disorder, like REM sleep disorder. There was a famous case, or before I say that, they basically think that, you know, as younger people sleepwalk, they're kind of lethargic. They don't really know what they're doing. It's pretty easy to steer somebody back into their bedroom.
Right.
As you get older, it's harder to do that. They, when confronted, these sleepwalkers might act out rashly or in violent ways. And again, researchers don't know why. This is part of the big mystery of sleep. You know, one of the most famous cases of sleepwalking, it was in the late 80s. Somebody, a man named Ken Parks, he drove 20 miles to about 20 miles, it was 14 miles, to his in-law's house. He let himself in with his key. And then he proceeded to stab his mother-in-law to death and almost beat his father-in-law to death with a tire iron over the head and choked him. He goes then immediately to a police station and he says, you know, I think I was in a bad accident and I don't know what it was. And he looks down and his hands are cut to the bone and he's, you know, pool of blood underneath him. At the trial the next year, his attorneys and you know, doctors too, convinced the jury that he was sleepwalking the entire time and he was acquitted.
Let's go to the phones. Stephen is with us in Provo, Utah. Stephen, welcome.
Hi, thank you. I just always been interested to know what sleep does to our body to refresh us. I understand why we hydrate and why we need to eat and what that does for our body, but I've never understood, you know, why it is we need to sleep or else we go, you know, nuts.
Yeah. It's true, actually. David Randall?
Oh, that's a great question. There's kind of split it in two ways. You know, physically, sleep is the time when our bodies just kind of repair themselves on a cellular level. You know, our brains send out growth hormone, which basically helps us, you know, prepare for each day and get ready for the next. But just as importantly, sleep does so many things for us mentally. The longest documented case of someone going without sleep was a teenager in the 1960s in San Diego. And he went 11 days continuously without sleep. And this was documented by a team from Stanford who read about it in the paper beforehand and flew down just to make sure he wasn't going to sleep. And over the first day or so, he was okay. But then things went south very quickly. You know, he started becoming paranoid, asking why everybody was doing this to him. He lost the ability to add simple numbers in his head. And then he essentially had, you know, a very bad acid trip. He saw visions. He heard phantom sounds. And he kind of lost a sense of who he was. Most of us will never go that far, obviously. But researchers now realize that sleep is an important time for learning, for decision-making, and for creativity as well. They do this through dream studies in part. Yeah. There was a famous research study done by Robert Stickgold. He's a professor at Harvard Medical School. And he had subjects play Tetris, you know, the video game where you sort shapes before they fell asleep. And then he asked them throughout the night, you know, he'd woke them up and asked, what are you dreaming about? When he woke them up in the first stages of sleep, you know, the first couple hours, it was almost as if a literal interpretation. You know, what were you dreaming about? Oh, I was dreaming about sorting shapes as they were falling. But then he woke them up right before they would naturally wake up, you know, 4 in the morning, late part of sleep.
Yeah.
And it had changed from this literal interpretation to almost as if the brain was frantically trying to find connections between things. Mm-hmm. You know, in one study, they had subjects play this video game where they were essentially, you know, skiing down a hill. And at the first part of the night, they thought, oh, you know, I was going down a hill incredibly fast. And then the second part of the night was, you know, I was on this moving sidewalk and I couldn't change what I was doing. And I was, you know, doing this and that. It was as if the brain had gone into a little bit of analysis. It was as if, you know, here was the demand placed on the brain this day. It realized perhaps I might need to do this again. How does this compare with what I already know?
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why researchers now think that the dreams you have right before you wake up seem so crazy. It's because there's all these things coming from your long-term memory, and they're trying to find connections with what you learned that day.
You know, what's great about this chapter in the book is that it really kind of calls into question our ideas of dreams that we've had for decades and decades, that dreams are some kind of, you know, psychological manifestation, that they represent, you know, that they're images, that are metaphors and they're symbols. This sort of turns that on its head and to say that dreams are really actually maybe not that, that there's something kind of more practical. They're, as you put it in the book, kind of a dress rehearsal for our lives.
Exactly. I went into the chapter on dreams thinking that dreams were essentially meaningless.
Yeah.
You know, I thought that especially the idea that, you know, if I dream about something, I'm sending coded messages to myself that reveal my deep and dark desires. That sounded like a plot device out of a terrible soap opera. Mm. So I went into this very, very skeptical. But then I started talking with people. You know, I talked with Dr. William Dumhoff, who's a professor at UC Santa Cruz. And with one of his colleagues, he had collected over 50,000 dream studies or dream logs. And basically, they started treating all these dreams not as if they were full of symbols, but as if they were just short stories. Mm-hmm. And let's look at them in terms of data. What happens if you dream about somebody you don't know? What happens if you dream about this or about that? And they realized that dreams, far from being kind of this mystical world, are remarkably straightforward. And most dreams are remarkably unpleasant. You know, we tend to dream about things that make us anxious. You know, if most of us have the experience of starting a new job and the night before having a terrible dream that you're messing up everything. And the idea might be, the theory now is that, you know, dreams are a chance for our brains to kind of go through this worst case scenario, practice how you might respond, and then give a chance to be ready for it for the next day. There's also this idea that dreams are a way for us to get rid of, to work through kind of traumatic experiences. I was in a car accident one time. It was a head-on collision. And, you know, luckily I was fine, and the person in the car with me, you know, had a broken arm, but that was about it. But for the next week or so, I had, you know, detailed nightmares about this. I would see the car that hit us, you know, slow motion. But then over, you know, a week or so later, those dreams kind of started just to go away. And the theory now is that as your brain works through this kind of traumatic experience and puts it to the long-term memory, it's a sign that you've kind of come to grips with it. You've healed. And the theory is that, you know, in the book I call this, you know, unscientifically, obviously, the well-adjusted caveman theory.
Right.
That if you can come to grips with all the traumatic experiences that have happened to you, you're going to be able to come back the next day and perform better than somebody who can't.
David Randall is with us. His book is Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. And we need to take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with journalist David Randall. We're talking about his book, Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. Let's go to the phones. Aaron is with us in Sandy, Utah. Aaron, welcome.
Thank you. Sure. Hi, David. Thanks for taking my call. I just kind of wanted to ask a basic question about maybe methods of improving sleep. I am a notorious really deep sleeper and, for example, can't hear my kids in the middle of the night. And my wife is the complete opposite, where nearly anything will wake her, and she sleeps terribly. And so without going to, like, a sleep institute and spending lots of money to have that examined, I was looking for some basic tips. I also thought it was particularly interesting your connection between estrogen and melatonin, that is. It seems like sometimes melatonin doesn't necessarily help her sleep, and we were actually talking the other day about estrogen deficiencies on the subject of unwanted hair growth in certain places. And so it seems like we're slowly putting the pieces together, and I was hoping maybe you could speak to those chemicals and also just better tips on sleeping.
Well, one of the things you do say, David Randall, and we should point out it that this isn't a 10-step process for getting people to sleep better. I mean, it's not to say you can't address the question, but I guess it comes up like that. Like, help me sleep, David Randall.
Yeah, that's one thing. I mean, I'm not a doctor. I'm somebody with sleep problem myself, which is why I was interested in this. But, you know, part of the research and one of the more interesting parts of sleep science that I found is that now doctors are starting to look at what goes into a good night's sleep.
Yeah.
You know, for so long, it was always the idea of, you know, what happens when sleep goes wrong? You know, this is why we have sleeping pills. This is why we have all these other things. Well, how can we do this without going to that? And one big part of this is realizing, you know, it seems obvious, but the effect of light. When you see your iPad at night, when you see a television, when you see a computer monitor, that whitish blue light, your brain interprets it as sunlight. Mm-hmm. You know, we're built for a universe where the sun is the only bright thing. It's kind of running the show. Now we have so much bright light that it tricks our brain into thinking, this is sunlight, I should stay up longer. And if you're somebody who naturally sleeps pretty on the lighter side, that's harder to deal with. It's harder to then fall asleep naturally. There's other things too. Sleep scientists basically call it sleep hygiene, which is a term I don't necessarily like. It kind of makes me think that all other sleep is dirty for some reason. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's all these other things where it's, you know, studies have shown that part of your body temperature dropping is what helps bring on sleep naturally. So you can take a very hot shower or, you know, conversely, you can take a very cold shower. And the idea of that your body temperature is dropping, you are naturally able to fall asleep a little bit better. Mm. You know, watching your exposure to light, doing things like reading, kind of having a calm time before you go to bed. You know, there's this cultural idea that sleep should be easy at all times,
yeah.
as if it's, you know, this elegant on-off switch that we flip whenever we want to. But it does take work. And a lot of that is changing your behaviors, which can be very difficult. That is, in some ways, more difficult than just saying, I'm going to take an Ambien or I'm going to take a Lunesta or something else.
Yeah. Which kind of leads us to a researcher that you write about, a fellow by the name, a British researcher named Neil Stanley, who created this huge stir when he suggested that sharing a bed is great for sex, but not much else. And he says, look, people like Aaron, who have a hard, you know, his wife doesn't sleep so well, he sleeps pretty well, they should sleep alone. And you write about how that was kind of akin, I think you said, to a social grenade.
Exactly. It was almost as if that that old Seinfeld joke about sleeping together, you know, it should be sex. It should not be literally sleeping together, that the whole sleeping part somehow got mixed in with all of that else. And that's not sleep. So his research basically showed that someone who shares a bed is, you know, about 50% more likely to be disturbed during the night than someone who sleeps alone. And other studies have shown that if you sleep by yourself in your bed at night, you're going to spend longer, you're going to fall asleep quicker generally, and you're going to spend longer amount of times in the deeper stages of sleep. And you kind of extrapolate this over a lifetime, you're going to be healthier if you sleep in your own bed at night. But at the same time, this is far from romantic.
Yeah.
You know, subjects, you know, the brainwaves showed that they had better sleep when they slept, you know, in a single bed, but they still said, I want to sleep in the same bed with somebody else.
Yeah.
So there's kind of this idea of there's a conflict between the heart and the head. Another researcher I spoke with, Wendy Troxell at the University of Pittsburgh, she had this interesting idea. She looked at, okay, men and women who are, you know, married, how when they're sleeping together, what are the outcomes of that? Hmm. And she realized that a woman's sleep quality is one of the best predictors of happiness in a marriage. That when women sleep, where wives were sleeping better, their husbands were feeling the better effects of this because simply they were, you know, in better moods. They were feeling better about themselves. So there's this idea that, you know, for so long we kind of have seen separate beds as, you know, perhaps evidence of a failed marriage or something's going wrong. But now, you know, if you have that conversation about, you know, we're sleeping in separate beds not because I don't love you, but because, you know, you kick me or you snore very loudly or, you know, you have that CPAP machine and it drives me nuts.
Right.
If you're just focusing on your selfish parts of sleep, that makes you a person perhaps that you want to be around more. So this, you know, obviously there's also the flip side of that, who people who say, you know, I've played so many roles in life. You know, I'm at work, I'm a parent, I'm a this person, I'm a that person. When I'm in bed with my, you know, significant other at night, that's my backstage time. That's when I don't have to play any roles. And that's when I can just kind of be me and not have to worry about it. And that's very important for some people. So, you know, it's not this idea where sleeping in by yourself is great and sleeping in a separate, you know, or sleeping in a bed with somebody else is terrible. It's, you know, there are different outcomes and it's all about what works best in your situation.
You, in that section of the book, you write about how our sleeping traditions are kind of complicated. And I love this part where there was this concern that came up in the 19th century about how one partner was stealing their other partner's invisible electrical charges.
Yeah, exactly. It was almost as if, you know, that was the same time when Darwin became suddenly so popular. So it was this idea that we're always in competition, and you could even be in competition with the person you're sleeping next to.
Yeah.
You know, who's going to get the better air? Who's going to, you know, be more comfortable? So that was single beds became so popular, especially among, you know, kind of the middle class. This was the idea of, you know, I want to be the best version of myself I can be, and I'm scared of the person next to me that they're going to basically attack me when my defenses are down.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, why turn of the century, it was so popular to see separate beds. And then in the 50s or 60s or so, that's when, you know, the shared bed became popular again. You know, most of us, if you think back to I Love Lucy, they were sleeping in separate beds.
Right. Dennis is with us in Bricks, New Jersey. Dennis, welcome.
Oh, thanks, Doug. I love the show. What I was calling about was something that a previous caller said about what does it do for the body and the mind to sleep? And I often thought that your mind gets more of a benefit from it than your body. And I always said it was kind of analogous to when someone defrags a computer, you're pretty much taking all the things in your mind that are associated with each other, and they're kind of grouping it together, and it makes you so you can think a little clearer. I was just wondering if your guest has any insight into that idea.
It makes sense.
Yeah, that's a great analogy too. And there have been studies that show basically what you're saying works out in real life. There was this one famous study. It was by researchers at a college in Germany. And they gave subjects a pretty simple math test. You know, it was nothing more than addition and subtraction. And the answer was, you know, you had to do a couple of these problems. And each answer then was six of these numbers in a row. Mm. So, you know, perhaps the final answer for the first one would be, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. But then they kind of added this twist to the study. And it was very subtle that if the first answer was six digits, the second part of that answer would always be the mirror of the first. So it would be 1, 2, 3, 3, 2, 1, or, you know, 4, 5, 6, 6, 5, 4. It was a very, very subtle pattern. And they had subjects do a couple of these tests, go through several of them, you know, maybe 20 sets, to see if any of them picked it up. And none of them did. So then they had part of the group go to sleep normally, and the other part to stay awake. You know, the ones who slept, some of them slept all night, some took a nap. Then they came back and had them do the same thing. And those who slept were so much more likely to eventually discover this pattern than those who had stayed awake. It was almost as if they showed a better command of flexible thinking. Mm. They could establish patterns, and those who weren't sleeping were kind of set in their ways. They were kind of interpreting it literally, always going by the book. And if you discovered the subtle pattern, suddenly you only had to solve half of the problems each time. So those who discovered it ended up completing the exams, you know, 75% faster than those who didn't. And you see similar things, and, you know, studies have been done with people in the military. As they go longer and longer without sleep, they forget to do basic things. Mm-hmm. And those who are able to take naps are able to have these cognitive breakthroughs that others don't.
Jay writes this email. He said, I had a biology teacher in high school who was fascinated with cats, and at the time he was experimenting personally with cat naps. His theory was that, like cats, humans all could function well by taking a series of naps rather than sleeping for one long period in a day. Jay writes, the idea always fascinated me. Is there any studies out there that support the theory?
That's a great theory, and some people do try to do this. And kind of going back to Seinfeld,
yeah.
One episode, Kramer famously tried to do this himself. It's very difficult though in the real world. Part of it is, you know, earlier we were talking about the circadian rhythm.
Mm.
There are certain times we're naturally built to be awake. You know, we wake up naturally around 9 or 10 o'clock. In the morning, we would, if it wasn't for coffee and lights and everything else. But we almost get this boost of energy, and we can't do anything about it.
Mm.
And that kind of wears off about 2 o'clock. And that's why most of us feel sleepy after noon. It's not because we ate. It's because we have this dip in circadian rhythm. Then we get another boost around 6 o'clock at night, and this kind of takes us to 10 p.m. when we naturally fall asleep. So trying to stay in the cycle of cat naps, you know, staying awake for 3 hours, then sleeping for 30 minutes, then waking back up, that's very, very difficult. And you're also not going to get into these deeper stages of sleep, which are the most restorative for both our mind and our body. And going on with this idea of circadian rhythms, you see this, that we have so little control over it. You see its outcomes, especially in sports. If you think about Monday Night Football, it always takes place at 8:30 p.m. Eastern time. You know, whether that's when the kickoff is. Either if you're in Seattle or if you're in New York, it's always the same time. So researchers at Stanford, again, decided, let's see the impact of this. Perhaps there's a circadian rhythm or advantage or disadvantage, depending on how you look at it, from having these East Coast teams play the West Coast team always at the same time. They looked at it this over 25 years, and they discovered that West Coast teams, when playing an East Coast team, were much more likely to beat the point spread. And the simple reason they decided upon was that their bodies were at a different stage in the sleep cycle than those who weren't. They had a very subtle advantage. You know, when you're at your peak of your sleep cycle, your circadian rhythm, studies have shown that you can lift a little bit more weights. Long jumpers can jump a little bit farther. Swimmers can swim just a little bit faster. And in football, when everything is so tightly matched, this really has strong outcomes.
That's David Randall. His book is Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. Joined us from the studios of NPR New York City. David Randall, thanks very much for the time.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Radio West, production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.